The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Sarah Goddard. I'm the Associate Director of Author Events. Tonight, we welcome two novelists, Lionel Shriver and Laura Lipman. Before we get started, if you could take a moment to silence your cell phones. After both writers speak, they will take questions from the audience together and then sign copies of their books upstairs in the lobby. Our first author tonight will be Lionel Shriver, most famous for her 2005 Orange Prize-winning novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin, a novel about maternal ambivalence in a Columbine-style shooting. Lionel Shriver has published 8 novels, including Game Control and A Perfectly Good Family. She's also a frequent contributor to The Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, and The Independent of London. Her new novel, The Post-Birthday World, tracks 2 different romantic fates for one woman after an illicit kiss at a party and leads the reader into challenging questions like, how much difference does it really make whom we choose to love? The author herself says, this is a novel about trade-offs, since in my experience, when you gain in one area by switching lovers, you lose in another. Our second author this evening is Laura Lipman, author of the Tess Moynihan Mysteries and winner of nearly every Mystery Writers Award, including the Edgar, the Anthony, the Agatha, the Seamus, Nero Wolfe, Gumshoe, and Barry Awards. Ms. Lipman was a reporter for 20 years, including 12 years at the Baltimore Sun. She began writing novels while working full-time and published 7 books about the accidental PI test before leaving daily journalism in 2001. Her books include To the Power of Three, Baltimore Noir, No Good Deeds, and most recently, What the Dead Know, about which Janet Maslin's New York Times review raved, you read it once just to move breathlessly toward the finale, then you revisit it to marvel at how well Miss Lipman pulled the wool over your eyes. Today is the pub date for her new Tess Moynihan mystery. In a note on her website, she writes, behold the schedule. 4 events on pub date alone. That's 4 events in 4 different zip codes, 3 different area codes, 2 states, 1 on either side of the Mason-Dixon line. 4 events, 2 with independent bookstores, 1 with Barnes & Noble, and a 4th at a public library. That's us. So we're number 4 today. So we're fortunate to be that public library. We're also fortunate to catch her at the on the very first day of a tour that lasts more than a month and have more than 35 events. Please join me in welcoming both authors, Lionel Shriver and Laura Lipman.
Good evening. Before we get started, I'd be curious, how many of you, since this is a paperback tour for me, how many have you read Post-Birthday World? Several. What about We Need to Talk About Kevin? Many of the same people. But enough of you haven't that I thought I'd explain the concept. My protagonist is named Irina, and she's been living for almost 10 years with a man named Lawrence. Irina is a children's book illustrator. Lawrence works for a think tank. They're both American, but they live in London. And Irina regards herself as perfectly happy with Lawrence. They have the kind of steady state, companionable relationship that I think a lot of us would probably recognize. 4 years now they've been getting together with another couple, a writer with whom Irina has worked illustrating children's books, and her husband, Ramsey Acton. Ramsey is, of all things, a professional snooker player. Does everyone know what snooker is? Yes, a few nods. You've read the book. Snooker is a variation on billiards. It resembles pool in some regards, but has very different rules. And most of all, it's much harder. It's played on a table which is literally twice as big. It's 12 feet by 6, if you can imagine. The balls are littler. The pockets are littler. Most of all, snooker is huge in Britain. One of these tournaments is on, the BBC will spend up to 12 hours of a broadcast day on snooker. Well, Lawrence happens to be a big snooker fan, but Irina isn't. And she's always felt a little bit uncomfortable around Ramsay Acton. She imagines it's because his profession doesn't especially interest her and they don't have much to talk about. So for years now, they've been getting together on Ramsay's birthday, just by coincidence at first, but it became a tradition. And when we begin the book, this year's going to be different, because it's not going to be a foursome. Florence is away in Sarajevo at a conference. Ramsay and his wife have divorced. And so if she's going to continue this tradition, it's going to be just the two of them. She dreads it. But when they go out to dinner, bizarrely, they have a wonderful time. A bit too wonderful time for someone who's perfectly happy. And against her better judgment, she goes back to his house. And while he goes down to his basement snooker parlor and starts hitting practice frames and totally ignoring her, she's overcome with a desire to kiss him. He is a very handsome man, which she's never exactly noticed before. You know that kind of exactly. And she has to make a decision. Ramsay's a nice enough guy and is friends with Lawrence as well, and it's very clear that he's not going to make a move. So if anyone's going to do it, she's going to have to kiss him. But she's a loyal person and wouldn't do something like that lightly. Many people would encounter this decision, and it wouldn't matter that much. You know, you might be able to shake it off in the morning, but Rena's not like that. She's a pretty serious person. And at the very end of the first chapter, she leans over his snooker table and says, "I almost forgot. Happy birthday." And you don't know what she does until you turn the page. It's chapter 2. Lawrence is coming home from Sarajevo, and he walks in the door, and it's Lawrence she can't talk to. And the evening is bizarrely awkward. They have an awful time. They end up watching TV. And when she goes to bed that night, she kicks herself because she feels that in a single evening, she had given in to temptation to kiss Ramsay Acton and ruined almost a 10-year relationship. And she wishes that maybe this time it would be possible to turn back the clock. Maybe she should have done something differently, controlled herself. Well, you turn the page, and lo and behold, it's chapter 2 again. And Lawrence is coming home from Sarajevo, and she's delighted to see him. And they have a wonderful time. Well, that's the side of the book in which she didn't give in to temptation and kiss Ramsay Acton. The book proceeds in that fashion with two chapter 2s, two chapter 3s, etc. And it closes on a single last chapter. The purpose of it was not just a literary exercise. I was interested in looking at what difference it makes whom we love, whom we marry. What effect does it have on our careers, on our friendships, on our relationships with our families? And to get the answers to those questions, you have to buy the book. But in the course of writing it, I discovered that there was only one thing that's harder to write about than sex, which anybody who's tried their hand at fiction realizes is difficult. Harder still is to write about contentment. I think you'll find that very little fiction addresses it. Contentment is usually, you know, the half page before the burglar bursts in and shoots your family, right? So we rarely dwell on it. Fictionally, we think of it as nothing happening. And sometimes that is what it is. But especially in the Lawrence side of the book, when she stays with him, I wanted to get down that kind of daily, domestic, all is right with the world. And so I am going to deliberately read you three passages this evening that are arguably some of the dullest in the entire novel. This is the evening, this is in the side of the book that Irina did not kiss Ramsey. It's the evening that Lawrence has come home from Sarajevo. Tucked into her armchair, Irina forked a first bite of rhubarb cream pie with a sensation that all was right with the world, or her world, the only one that mattered at the moment. The creamy filling was balanced perfectly between tart and sweet and struck a satisfying textural counterpoint with the crisp lattice crust. Late Review had just run its opening credits. Germaine Greer was on tonight, an articulate woman who had once been a knockout, but who had aged honestly and was still classically handsome. She was that rare animal, a feminist with a sense of humor, who stuck to her guns, but was not a pain in the ass. Moreover, this 50-something writer radiated a compensatory beauty of wisdom and personal warmth. Germaine gave Irina hope for her own future and broadly bolstered her pride in her gender. The waft from the open windows was the ideal temperature. She was not a faithless hussy. Lawrence was home, and they were happy. Yet Irina had once tucked away, she wasn't quite sure when or why, that happiness is almost definitionally a condition of which you are not aware at the time. To inhabit your own contentment is to be wholly present, with no orbiting satellite to take clinical readings of the state of the planet. Conventionally, you grow conscious of happiness at the very point that it begins to elude you. When not misused to talk yourself into something, when not a lie. Happy is a classification applied in retrospect. It is a bracketing assessment, a label only decisively pasted onto an era once it is over. She didn't intend to be dire, or to detract from her pleasure in Lawrence's return, Germaine Greer's astute commentary on Boogie Nights, and the splendid rhubarb cream. In fact, Irina reasoned that for so much of the world to be roiling with war and animosity, then there must be an international deficit of compelling men, BBC Two reception, and pie. Still, there was a weed in this garden, or none of her self-congratulation would have made itself felt. She had only been alerted to her own happiness by a narrow brush against an alternative future in which it was annihilated. The next passage is in the same side of the book. She's still with Lawrence, and it's the next morning. The bedclothes were seductive, but with Lawrence up, the swaddling lost its appeal. Lawrence would sometimes let her sleep in, but whenever Irina arose and found him away to work, she felt dolorous and cheated. So she crawled out of bed. Even if they didn't chat much in the morning, percolating side by side without having to talk was its own pleasure, and it was nice to begin the day as a team. She entered into the clockwork of their morning routine. Some people found the infinite iterations of home life tedious. For Irina, its rhythms were musical. The Shriek of the Grinder was the day's opening fanfare. She welcomed a refrain to which she could almost hum along. The gurgle and choke of the stovetop espresso pot, the roar and strangle of the steamer wand as she whipped the milk to froth. If duplicating the same proportions every morning lent her coffee preparation an inevitable monotony, she wouldn't opt for too little milk just because making her coffee badly was different. There was nothing tiresome about having established that because Lawrence liked his toast on the dark side, the ideal setting on the toaster was halfway between 3 and 4. The properties of repetition, she considered, were complex. Up to a point, repetition was a magnifier, an elevated habit to ritual. Taken too far, it could grow erosive and grind ritual to the mindless and rote. In kind, the pound of surf, depending on the tides, could either deposit sand on the shore or wear it away. While Irina was not averse to variety, sometimes the coffee was from Ethiopia, others from Uruguay. Overall, variety was overrated. She preferred variation within sameness. If you were voracious for constant change, you ran out of breakfast beverages in short order. She had some appreciation for folks with a greed for sensation, who were determined, as an old boyfriend used to say, to squeeze the orange and press fresh experience from every day. But that way lay burnout. There were only so many experiences, really, a depressing discovery in itself. And surely you were better off trying to replicate the pleasing ones as often as possible. Furthermore, that impression of infinite repetition, of having coffee and toast over and over and over, numbingly into the horizon, is an illusion. Boredom with routine is a luxury, and one unfailingly brief. You are awarded a discrete number of mornings and are well advised to savor every single awakening that isn't marred by arthritis or Alzheimer's. You will drink only so many cups of coffee. You will read only so many newspapers and not one edition more. You glory in silent communion with your soulmate at the dining table a specific quantifiable number of times, so inclined you could count them. Before wham, from one calamity or another, at least one of you isn't there anymore. Not so long ago, Irina had feared a falling out, one that would shake her faith in the whole romantic project. But that anxiety had been latterly eclipsed by the more powerful fear that Lawrence would die. Thus a growing sense of security in one realm begot an accelerating sense of menace in another, one in which the whole project was jeopardized in a more absolute regard. Whenever Irina read those listings in news articles of how many meals the average person totals over a lifetime, how many years he spends sleeping, how many individual instances he will go to the loo, she was never dazzled by all those digits, but humbled by their paltriness and finitude. According to the actuarial average, this was one of only 78 summers that she was likely to sample, and 42 were dispatched. It was shocking. One more passage. You're not getting out so easily. This is the end of that chapter. It's that evening. The concept behind the holiday of Thanksgiving in the States was all very laudable. Nevertheless, it doesn't work. It is nigh impossible to sincerely count your blessings on the last Thursday of November because you're supposed to. The occasion is reliably squandered on fretting that the turkey breast is drying out while those last morsels on the inner thighs are still running red. Yet thankfulness can descend unscheduled. When Lawrence cried, "Irina Galina," at the door that evening, and Irina rejoined from her studio, "Lawrence Lorencevich," she was grateful. When he told her about his day over peanut butter crackers, his contacts had passed on a rumor that the IRA ceasefire would soon be reinstated. She may never have quite understood the fracas in Ulster, nor have kept up with whether its paramilitaries were or were not bombing the bejesus out of Britain these days, nor have comprehended why they would do such a thing in the first place. But still, she was grateful that Lawrence had work that fascinated him, whether or not it fascinated her, that he cared enough to fill her in about what he did during the day and respected her opinion, that were she to ask him, he would patiently explain the ins and outs of Northern Ireland in whatever detail she wished, that he would not take offense if just tonight she gave the explanation amiss. When they settled in front of the Channel 4 news, she was grateful that she wasn't a dairy farmer watching his herd go up in smoke. While she was confessedly growing fatigued with the mad cow disease story, by and large, British newscasts were superior to their American counterparts, more serious, more in-depth. And she was grateful for that, too. Preparing their traditional pre-dinner popcorn, Irina was thankful for another routine of perfectly balanced variation within sameness. She had worked out the exact oil-to-kernel ratio that would maximize loft and minimize grease. One shelf of her spice rack was devoted to so many ethnic toppings, Cajun, Creole, fajita mix, that she could now serve a differently seasoned bowlful every day of the month. Tonight she chose black pepper, parmesan, and garlic powder, a favorite combination. And as they decimated the batch, she was glad of a snack that you could gorge on that would not fill you up. Picking up the remnants of cheese at the bottom of the bowl with a moistened forefinger, Irina considered that they were both in perfect health. And sometimes physical well-being could convert from the blank space between ailments to witting pleasure. Entering middle age, they remained a handsome couple. She'd survived a rash bout of chocolate cappuccino cake, and she still wasn't fat. No one close to her had recently died. Lawrence, grumbling over when this protracted segment on BSE would ever be over, was conspicuously alive. Dinner, the chicken had been marinating in a deadly Indonesian jerk sauce all afternoon, would be smashing. Nothing was wrong. Most of all, the air between them was clear. She may have kept quiet about a couple of purely interior moments with Ramsay Acton over the weekend, but she had granted herself permission this afternoon to hold those slight cards close to her chest. If Saturday night's disquieting temptation had sent a tremor through this flat, the earth had stilled again. It was surely not naive to believe that neither she nor Lawrence was hiding any great secret from the other. Lawrence was not covertly gambling away their savings at OTB. If he said he went to the gym on his lunch hour, to the gym he went. Nor was he going through the motions of heading to the office every day when in truth he'd been sacked months ago. Maybe she did sneak an occasional cigarette. But Irina was not popping amphetamines while Lawrence was at work. She hadn't developed a furtive morning sherry habit or a stealthy dependence on Valium. Lawrence did not harbor a whole other family in Rome whom he visited while pretending to attend a conference in Sarajevo. So, while it was possible that a pizza delivery boy would press the wrong buzzer, there was no chance that their doorbell would be rung tonight by a sullen teenager whom Lawrence hadn't admitted to siring years ago, who now wanted money. Irina wasn't brooding through the news over how to break it to Lawrence that her self-absorbed mother could no longer afford the upkeep of her house in Brighton Beach and would be moving into their spare bedroom next week. Lawrence wasn't brooding through the news over how to break it to Arena that after all these years, he had come to the realization that he was gay. And on Saturday night, Arena hadn't kissed another man while Lawrence was away. Some years, Thanksgiving arrives in the lowercase in July. Thank you. Laura, it's all yours.
What an act to follow. Actually, it's going to seem as if we got together and planned something, because what I plan to read is much more dialogue intensive, which I'm especially glad of after hearing that quite gorgeous prose. A couple of things before I start. I wanted to talk a little bit about a sickness among most of the writers I know. I won't say all of the writers, but a lot of the writers I know have this sickness for material. And this first came to my attention when I was at a conference of writers who, like myself, write private eye fiction. And one of the writers among us had served time in federal prison. He was an art dealer who had defrauded his clients because he was also a drug addict. He would sell the same painting many times over, and all of the profits went into his arm, and this eventually caught up with him. And then he managed to write a novel, a very good one, and sell it for quite a bit of money. And we just all sat around him, leaning in closely, wanting all the details about what was life in prison like, and what did you eat in prison, and life on the prison bus. And it became clear that we were envying him. And one of my friends, who I think is wiser and quicker than I was, said, "This is what's wrong with writers. We envy him his material." And his material is that he was a drug addict who was in a federal prison. Writers are an odd lot. I sort of married one in spite of myself. And I remember in the early days of our courtship, I actually wrote him a letter that said, "I believe that writers, if not by law, then by social custom, should be prohibited from ever marrying one another." But then I married a writer who gave me material. My husband has worked on a television show for the last 6 years. It happened to come to an end Sunday night. Yeah. Yes, it's that television show. My husband was the executive producer of The Wire. And this has been part of our life the entire time we've been together. And whether I wanted to or not, I absorbed a lot about how television was made. And the thing was, at the same time, I've always wanted to have this very distinct life and identity away from my husband's. So I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into that world, because I knew the kind of questions it would invite and the things that people would read into it. So what I decided I was going to do is that I was going to create a television show that could never be confused with The Wire. Step one, it had to be very, very, very stupid. So the television show that I have created in this book is a show about a steelworker who hits his head and time travels to the early 19th century, where he falls in love with Baltimore belle Betsy Patterson, whose destiny is to marry the brother of Napoleon, Jerome, a marriage that will end in divorce. The name of the steelworker is Herman Mann. So the show, of course, is called Man of Steel. That still wasn't enough. If I wasn't going to have anyone confuse my fictional world with the life that I've been living, I also had to make sure that the people behind the television show could never be confused with the people that I'd grown to know so well. So instead of having, you know, a former Baltimore Sun reporter and a former Baltimore cop work together, I had to create two Hollywood slicksters. People who don't know Baltimore at all, who don't respect it and don't like it, which, if you've read any of my novels, you know that that's a very bad sign. People who don't like Baltimore don't turn out very well in my novels, at least in the novels about Tess Monahan. So I created these two young writers in their early 30s And one is the son of a very famous director who was originally from Baltimore. And the other is just the kind of guy you meet in Southern California who grows up wanting to do nothing but write for film and television. And the only problem is that he has no life experience to write about. And so these two young men are named Flip Tumulty, short for Philip, and Ben Marcus. And this recurring character that I write, Tess Monahan, has been drawn into their world very much against her will. Now, I write two kinds of books. And there was, by the way, no plan involved. It just evolved this way. This is the 10th book I've written about Tess Monahan, a former reporter who became a private investigator. They are straight-up PI novels. That's what they are, and I'm proud of them for being that. A couple of years ago, I had an idea that didn't work for the world of Tess Monahan, and I wrote that novel. It was called Every Secret Thing, and it was very dark and very different. Then I went back to Tess, and I went back to a standalone. And in this way, I've been writing. I write a book a year by choice. Perhaps not always by choice. In the early days, I think I felt very much that I needed to prove that I could do this. At this point, my publishers basically said, write at the pace that you want to write at. And I find that a book a year is about right for me. I always say, people say, how long does it take you to write a book? And I say, well, it takes about 11 and a half months. I wish I had 14 because I would like to screw off for 2.5 months. But the thing, and you know, and there are these words that people use for people who write as quickly as I do. They're never very nice words. Crank, churn. They're all words that sort of imply a factory. And I'm just in there pressing the Play-Doh through my Play-Doh fun factory, and it comes out in different shapes every year. What is true about the way I write is that last year's book, What the Dead Know, was extremely dark and intense. I can't write a book like that every year. I think I would be psychotic. And I'm very grateful to be able to alternate these darker books that use up everybody, use up all the characters, and use up me when I'm writing them, with the known world of a series. I read series as a kid. I read them as an adult. There are very particular, specific pleasures in the series book for the reader, and in this case, for the writer. So I'm always glad to come back to writing about Tess Monahan. I don't find the books limited in any way. They are classic PI novels. And the scene that I would like to read for you, and I think I'll read two little portions. One is just an introduction for Tess, because I'm not going to assume that everyone here has had the chance to make her acquaintance. And this brief introduction at the beginning of the book, which puts her on a very literal collision course with Hollywood. The headphones were a mistake. She realized this only in hindsight, but then what other vision is available to a person heading backward into the world? True, they were good old-fashioned headphones, which didn't seal tightly to the ear, not earbuds, which she loathed on principle, the principle being that she was 34 going on 70. Furthermore, she had dialed down the volume on her Sony Walkman. Yes, a Sony Walkman. Sturdy and battered and taxicab yellow, not a sleek little iPod in more modern or electric shades. Still, for all her precautions, she could hear very little. And even Tess Monahan would admit that it's important to be attuned to the world when one is charging into it backward, gliding along the middle branch of the Patapsco in a skull, and passing through channels that are seldom without traffic, even in the pre-dawn hours. But Tess had painstakingly rationalized her way into trouble, which, she decided later, is pretty much how everyone gets into trouble, one small rationalization at a time. She wanted to row, yet she felt obligated to listen to her boyfriend on a local radio show promoting the Oktoberfest lineup at her father's bar. Besides, he planned to play some songs by Brave Combo, a nuclear polka band that Tess quite liked. She would row a path that was familiar to her and trust the coxswains for the fours and eights to watch her back, a courtesy offered to all scullers. It did not occur to Tess to row a little later or skip the workout altogether. The rowing season traditionally ended after Thanksgiving, a mere month away. She had to take advantage of every waning day, especially now that Baltimore was in its full autumnal glory. If aliens had landed in Baltimore on this particular October morning, they would have concluded that it was the most perfect city on the globe they were about to conquer. Truly the charm city it claimed to be. The trees were tinged with gold. Who's laughing at that? The trees were tinged with gold and scarlet. The breeze was light. The sky was slowly deepening into the kind of brilliant blue that reminded people they once knew the word cerulean, if only because it had been on the vocabulary list for the SATs. Tess set out for Fort McHenry at the distant tip of Locust Point, rationalizing every stroke of the ray. She knew the route so well. It was so early, the sun not even up. She'd beaten the other rowers to the water, arriving in darkness and pushing off from the dock at first light. She wouldn't wear the headphones on the way back. She just needed to hear her boyfriend on WTMD, listen to him play a few snippets of Brave Combo. Then she would turn off her Walkman, and that's when the police boat, bullhorn blaring, crossed into her line of vision and came charging toward her. By the time she registered everything that was happening, the approaching boat, the screams and shouts coming from all directions, the fact that someone was very keen that she stop or change course, the motorboat had stopped, setting up an enormous choppy wake that was going to hit her sideways. Tess, trying frantically to slow and steady her skull, had a bona fide moment of prescience. Granted, her vision extended only 2 or 3 seconds into the future, but it was uncannily exact. She was going to go ass over tea kettle into the Patapsco, a body of water that even conquering aliens from a water-deprived planet would find less than desirable. She closed her eyes and shut her mouth as tightly as possible, grateful she had no cuts or scratches into which microbes could swim. Tess has just met, although she doesn't know it yet, Flip Tumulty, the boss and executive producer of Man of Steel. And he will end up getting her to come work for him against her better instincts. And he hires her initially for security, but now something really awful has happened. There's been a murder on set. Tess thinks that she's on the verge of being fired, only to find out that things are slightly different than she anticipated. But what this is a discussion about movies between Flip and Tess. And it begins because he talks about how if he could, he would fire the actress who is playing Betsy Patterson and have the show continue without her. And Tess says, and lose the whole blue blood meets blue collar thing? I thought that was the concept that made the whole thing go. She didn't quite achieve the sincere tone she was trying for. Flip asks, are you this obnoxious to all the people who hire you, or do you sometimes manage to fake enthusiasm for their enterprises? It's the nature of my business to work for people with different tastes, values, essential even. I wouldn't work at all if I had to be gung-ho about all my clients' professional lives. Still, do you have to be such an asshole? A fair question under the circumstances. I don't mean to be a jerk. The broad outlines of the show you're doing, I'll admit it, I just don't get it. It's history, it's time travel, it's comedy, all set in the context of the never-neverland of a thriving steel company in the 21st century. Girl's house gets swept up by a tornado, and she's transported to a magical land where she expends all her power trying to get home again. Okay, yeah, but The Wizard of Oz is a fantasy. Billionaire media mogul whispers a mysterious name on his deathbed, launching a journalist attempt to understand the private man behind the public figure. Yet the truth about Rosebud doesn't really solve any of those mysteries. Well, it was rumored to be William Randolph Hearst's pet name from Marion Davies' nether regions, said Tess, grateful to have one of her boyfriend's bits of trivia so readily at hand. Okay, when you reduce anything to a thumbnail description, it sounds a little silly, but woman will do anything for the love of her ungrateful daughter, including confessing to the murder that the daughter committed. Mildred Pierce, Tess said, and there's no murder in the book, which is 1,000 times better. Man builds a baseball diamond in a cornfield behind his house, and Shoeless Joe Jackson appears. But now Flip had gone too far, a bridge too far, a baseball diamond too far. I hate that movie! The bare brick walls sent her voice bouncing into every corner of the restaurant. She regained her composure. Sorry, but do not get me started on that cornball mush. How can you hate Field of Dreams? It's a male weepy, as I think Pauline Kael or some other critic said. And you know, I'm okay with the male weepy. We all deserve our weepies. My issue is that what makes men cry is elevated to profundity, while what makes women cry is denigrated as sentimental. When you take my corn seriously, I'll grant yours equal respect. What makes you cry? Beaches? Major League, which is a better baseball movie than Field of Dreams, by the way. Even as Tessa's mouth provided that glib reply, her brain was thinking about what really did make her cry. There was a certain expression on her greyhound's face, a wisp of a seeming smile, the Bromo Seltzer Tower glowing blue in the night, old television footage of Brooks Robinson being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And there was the matter of a young woman, beaten to death just last night. But Tess wasn't hypocrite enough to admit that she felt anything but shock and dismay over that. The only thing that resonated was the violence of the death. A fatal beating took time, and not a little passion. Besides, Flip was talking about cinematic tears. Okay, then. Little Dominic dying in Noodle's arms in Once Upon a Time in America, but also Noodle's coming back through the bus station door, 30 years of time summed up in a single shot. Strictly ballroom, Tess admitted. When the music goes out and the father starts to clap and they show they can do the Paso Doble without any music at all, her eyes started to mist. Flip said, you haven't shot down my central point. Anything sounds ludicrous and boiled down to the pitch. But it's all in the execution. Why do you think Hollywood produces so much crap? Because there's seldom any economic penalty? No. People's careers do suffer from doing critically disdained work, if it's also commercially inert. The point, Flip said irritably, as if unused to being interrupted, and he probably was. The point is that the writing, the performances, the visuals, those will combine to make this show something really special. That's why we're starting small on a C-list cable network with only 8 episodes. People forget, but there was a time when getting a series on HBO was considered second rate. The Sopranos was pitched to the networks first, and they all passed. By the way, has anyone ever proposed adapting your life story? Food arrived, a house salad for Flip, a much heartier steak salad for Tess, and she was spared answering right away. Last year, I was involved in a case of some notoriety. Some producers circled for a while. You make them sound like vultures. Tess forked up a mouthful of steak and greens that required much judicious chewing. They were just doing their job, he persisted. Look, you go to the movies. You read newspapers and magazines, right? Well, the material has to come from somewhere. A friend of mine was killed in front of me. I killed a man. I never thought of it as material. Thank you.
So both of our authors will now take questions from the audience. We have a couple staff people in the aisles with microphones, so if you have a question, just raise your hand and we can call you out. They're right there on the aisle.
Is it on?
Yes, sir.
First of all. Thank you. Lionel, I loved your latest book. I was curious about why Irina had to pay so dearly for her decision to not kiss Ramsey.
Well, part of it was philosophical. Part of it was the demands of plot. Something had to happen in both sides of the book. But philosophically, I'm arguing that there's a price to be paid for everyone. And you're not going to be sure what that price is. You know, we have to go into relationships completely blind. You do not have the information you need to make an intelligent decision. And there's usually,
unless you're lucky and, you know, you have a very happy life together and you die first, and that's not generally the experience of most women, you're going to experience some tragedy with someone. And I wanted to express different kinds of tragedy in each of those two scenarios.
Another question, in towards the back.
Hi. My question is, as fiction writers, how do you realize your social responsibility in terms of, you know, what's happening in the world today, what's happening in this country today? How do you bring that into your writing?
You want to go first?
I'll go first. I mean, primarily as a crime writer, if I'm going to write about murder and violence, I do think there's a responsibility to actually make it kind of banal. There are some books that are very fun reads, that are very interesting, that have these great mastermind serial killers who are brilliant and do ritualistic things to bodies. But there came a point for me where I thought, you know, dead is bad enough. A bullet is bad enough. You don't need to have a serial killer roaming the landscape and disemboweling cheerleaders to make the point that murder is a horrible thing. And if anything, it seems to me when you write about really sensational murder, you keep the reader very safe in his or her armchair at home. The person who's reading about the mad, evil serial killer who's roaming the landscape and disemboweling cheerleaders doesn't really fear that person. That's not going to happen to them. You couldn't be more safe and snug when you're reading a book like that. But if you can write a book in which people who are much closer to the reader kind of bumble and stumble into doing really unthinkable things one step at a time, you've now made them consider the experience of what violence does to people, what it might actually like to be someone whose life has been torn apart by homicide. The section I read tonight, you know, Tess gets into trouble in that early little section, rationalizing every step of the way, and she later says that's how everyone gets into trouble. That's pretty much one of my philosophies in writing about the so-called bad guys in my book, is I try to show them as human and people who do horrible things, but who start off as human, recognizably human. So that's what I think my very singular responsibility is working in the genre that I work in.
It's similarly in We Need to Talk About Kevin, for example. I took great care not to glorify the school shooting. In fact, anybody who's read it knows it's not even a school shooting. Certainly not to glorify the kid who does it. I wanted to make it clear that when he killed those people, it was stupid. It was stupid and pointless, and there was nothing grand about it. And I guess you could say that that's, in a way, answering to social responsibility. But I would also say that to feel too constrained to make a point is dangerous. I mean, I don't mean anything terrible happens. You just write a bad book. But, for example, right now, the novel I'm working on is to do with American healthcare. And it makes me a little uneasy, because if the novel becomes too much of a proselytizing for one of our two Democratic candidates, you know, I'm opting for the mandate program, then I haven't written a fiction. I have written thinly disguised pamphlet. I don't think that's what fiction is for, and I think sometimes fiction works best when it is it's wrestling with orthodoxies, and even an author's own personal orthodoxies, rather than trying to put over a pat point of view. I think it's very hard to say what fiction is good for, but when it's falling too neatly into line behind effectively a party political position, or even, you know, it's important to pick up your trash, it's going to be trash.
Down here in the front.
Thanks. Hi, this question is for Lionel as well. Let's see if how I can phrase this. I read that you were talking in one of your intros about how traveling has kind of lost its allure to you because people are all the same. And I find it interesting that every single book you write is about something totally different. So basically what I'm asking is, what, I guess, common thread do you find with all these people? I mean, I think they're all very honest and they're all very complicated in very different ways. But do you find, well, number one, what common thread do you find with these characters? And do you see yourself in these characters at any point? All of them or some of them? I know it's a long question.
I guess there's a little bit of me in all of my characters. They tend to be distinguished by the fact that they're hard to like, and maybe that makes them like me, too. You end up liking them in spite of themselves if you do. I've never been interested in writing about paragons. I just think they're boring. And I'm also very mistrustful of conventional understandings of goodness. I find consciously, deliberately, dutifully good people unbearable. And I'm very suspicious of altruism, which I usually find is disguising something else. I'm essentially an extremely cynical person. insofar as I can make generalizations, that's about all I can say. It's true that I've addressed a lot of different material, and I'm running out. I mean, it's fortunate that the world around me changes because I'm little by little burning through all of my natural enthusiasms. I just used up snooker, for example. Thank God. Or tennis, you know. Probably those are the only sports that I follow. So that's the last sports novels. I've done demography and AIDS. You know, I guess there's always just old age and death. I'm already getting into that. But it's interesting you brought up that line that I said, if I'm remembering that interview correctly, that I was less interested in travel either because I'd come to the conclusion that everyone everywhere is the same, or I just got lazy. And I am certain I said my suspicion is the latter.
Another about halfway back there in white.
Laura, you mentioned that you were reading series. What are you guys reading right now? Do you have anything to recommend?
I'm right. It's a complicated question. I'm reading a perfectly lovely book, but not to...
Would you want anyone to say that about your book?
No.
A perfectly lovely book?
It's a really lovely book. I'm struggling with the context in which this book has been reviewed and heralded, because it's a terrific book, but it has been treated differently because it's been written by a man than it... It's a book called Beginner's Greek by James Collins. And there's just no doubt in my mind that if a woman had written this book, it wouldn't have been treated the same way, that it would have been dismissed as chick lit. And I have a hard time. I have to kind of like forget that. It's a wonderful book. It's nicely written. It does remind me. It's been compared to Jane Austen, which I think it's always a bit of a stretch when we compare anyone to Jane Austen. But Laurie Colwin, yes, and Laurie Colwin was one of my favorite writers. And this has the hallmark of that world that Laurie Colwin wrote about, where the people just had impossibly interesting and intellectual jobs, and somehow people never talked about how they made money, but they had chateaus in France. And I like that as a reader, but I guess I'm sometimes too candid, and as much as I admire it, I can't not forget that it's been treated differently because it was written by a man?
I just finished Martin Amis's collection of essays about reactions to 9/11 called The Second Plane, which is it's an uneven book but a very brave book. And what's interesting to me about it is that, especially since this book has been published some years after 9/11, his forceful denunciation of the culprits and of Islamicism in general and of religion of all kinds, which is I'm really into. That's going to be one of my next topics. It might have seemed just perfectly joining the chorus right after 9/11, but now we're a few years down the road. It seems like a right-wing reactionary weirdoism. You know, it's like, what's this guy's problem? And it's an illustration of how far we've traveled in I suspect in the direction of self-suspicion and apology and also carefulness. Extreme carefulness. Like, don't say anything mean about those people. that's a rare for me to read any nonfiction at all, so I'm very proud. And I'm about halfway through a book that isn't out yet, also published by HarperCollins by Jennifer Haig.
Oh, wow.
Called The Condition. Have you read any of that?
No, but I know I love Jennifer Haig's work. I'm very excited to know she has a new novel.
It's very good. I'm really enjoying it.
What's it called? So we know when it comes out. What's the title of her book?
Oh, it's called The Condition. Okay. I'm sure you'll be hearing about it.
Another question? Along the aisle there?
I'm from a different generation. And when I was coming up, my 20s, before then, I made sure I had the illusion that if I read every important novel, I would be educated.
You would be what?
Educated.
Educated, oh.
That was my goal. So I had to read Joyce, I had to read Tolstoy, I had to read the names. And those books had a profound effect on me. Of course, I never became educated, but that was an illusion. I always feel that there are no great characters. There are no longer people that you remember, that the general public understands are great characters that represent great themes. Is it that the art form of the novel has changed? Or life has changed, or...
Or you have.
Ah.
I've changed, too.
If you're looking at 19th century novels, one thing that has clearly changed is the movies have changed the way novels are written. People now have an experience in mind that is more visual, and as a result, the kind of novels that were written in the 19th century will not be written again, I don't think. It's very difficult. And truthfully, I don't think the modern reader would ever tolerate the level of coincidence that is in the 19th century novel. It's interesting because modern life has actually probably made us more aware of how much coincidence and happenstance there is. But you know what? If I try to write a novel where a governess ran away and she was taken in by these people who turned out to be her cousins and then she managed to help them get their inheritance, you know, I would be pilloried. I mean, there's just, so there are changes. Things do change, but I think there are all sorts of great characters in modern fiction. And I think I read a lot. There's a lot of terrific stuff out there to my taste. I mean, and there's also stuff that fails to please, but...
Yeah, I would take issue with your generalization since it condemns my characters too. I do think that what Laura said about cinema having influenced of modern literature, there's something to it. And one of the things that you may be noticing is that we are now accustomed in films, unlike in the theater, to the close-up, that we look at people close-up, and it's much subtler. And I think that, so you don't have the big gestures from the stage and the shouting and this, the grand kind of overdone so that it reads to the back of the back row. And I think fiction may be doing something of the same thing. That, I mean, in fact, the passages that I read this evening are very good examples. It's not centered exactly on character, but there are other passages that would be. You're looking at life-size people. You're not looking at larger-than-life people. In fact, earlier in my career, I was much more inclined to write about larger-than-life people, and I'm more and more interested in writing about regular-sized people. It's a taste thing. But I'll tell you, let me just throw up a suggestion that you try this book. There's a book called Gerard Woodward called I'll Go to Bed at Noon. It's British. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Okay.
No,
it's absolutely wonderful. It's hilarious. It's all about drinking. In other words, it's British. And it has some of the greatest characters I've ever encountered. They're really outsized. But without being stupid, you know, without being goofy, or that apparently this author wrote a lot from his own experience. Poor guy. And just try it. I'll Go to Bed at Noon by Gerard Woodward.
Okay, we have time for one more, or we can go to the lobby and sign. How about down here in the front?
It takes you about 1 to 3 years to write a book. It takes us a few days to a few weeks to read a book. We consume it. It's over for us unless we really love it and we come to hear the author speak. What's it like for you to have so many books behind you, characters that you created that are no longer extant for most people?
I'm sorry, I missed what you said. No longer what for most people?
Extant.
Ah. I think you can take that first.
Oh, okay. Well, again, it's one of the nice things about writing a series is that this one character comes back again and again along with many other characters. And, you know, I always said that I don't understand why more grown-ups don't have imaginary friends. I have a very satisfactory one, and I quite like spending time with her. It is interesting in the books I've written outside the series. I have a bit of a pang for using those people up and for not being able to go back to them because, you know, it's very intense. You spend a lot of time. It's not healthy to say this. I don't find it attractive. There are times in my life where I spend more time with imaginary people that I make up than I spend with flesh and blood people. And I don't think that is particularly healthy or laudable. It's just true. But, you know, at the end of it, yeah, it's strange. But the thing is that they go on for other people. It's not as if the book is only read in that month it comes out and then everyone else puts it away. People are constantly finding books and finding these characters, so they might come back to me and ask me, and so then that character is sort of alive for me again. And that's a lovely thing. I would be curious. I cannot bear to read. I don't read my books after I finish them. I mean, I read when I'm touring, and then it makes me almost physically ill to open my books again because all I'm going to see is what's not right. And all I'm going to see are errors, and I wish I'd done this, and I wish I'd done that. But it's bittersweet, to put it in a word.
I find that I don't sit around reading my own books either. I think I can't think of anything more pathetic. But because of that, my experiences of the books, the older books, they just start to retreat. And I think what happens is that the reader's and the author's experience begins to converge. That is, my own books begin to become books I read, of which I remember parts, right? In fact, I did have an interesting experience when my sixth novel, Double Fault, was published in Britain way after the fact, 8-10 years after I wrote it. So I hadn't touched it in ages, but because it was coming out in Britain, I had to do some publicity for it, which entailed doing this kind of event. And that meant I had to read some of it again. And it was so weird. I didn't recognize it. I didn't recognize whole scenes. I had forgotten about them. And it was really to the point where I wanted to turn the page to find out what happened next. And it was both liberating and frightening. It was liberating because obviously some umbilical had been cut. But it was frightening because when you can truly read your own book the way other people do, with that coldness, then you can't protect yourself from your own opinion of it. And I was relieved for the most part to, you know, think, huh, that's a pretty good line. But were I to have sat down and read the whole thing, I'm sure that I would come across others that disappointed me or made me shudder. So there's a kind of objectivity that I'm not sure you ever quite want.
Okay, I think we'll end there and take any more questions upstairs in the signing line. Can we wish both of all of your new characters long life? And please join us upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.